All right, good afternoon and welcome to this event. My name is Paul Fields and I work in the H. Henry Meter Center for Kelvin Studies. The center and the history department at Kelvin are putting on this event today. Professor Will Kederberg will actually introduce the speaker, but I just wanted to mention a couple of things. One, Franz said he will take questions at the and answers at the end of the his time, so there will be a little bit of, so get your thoughts ready for that. Also, his book is on sale in the campus bookstore, and they actually have a display right by the front door, and they are having a 20% off the price through the weekend, so make sure you buy your copies and many more for Christmas. So at this point,
it's
I will...
cheaper than you can get it on Amazon.
Oh. There you go. Oh. Great. Okay. That's right. Very good. So we'll turn it over to Will Kederberg.
Good afternoon. I'm Will Kederberg. I'm the chair of the History Department, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Franz von Lehre, today. Franz von Lehre is professor of history, director of the Medieval Studies program at Kelvin. He's been at Kelvin since 1998. Before that, he taught for several years at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. Franz got his graduate education at the University of Groningen, graduating with a PhD in medieval studies in 1995. His interests include medieval Europe, of course, medieval biblical exegesis, Jewish-Christian relations, schools and universities, and the Avignon Papacy. His publications include editions of Andrew of St. Victor's 12th century Bible commentaries on Samuel and Kings and the 12 prophets, which, if I remember right, was your dissertation topic or related to it?
One, yeah. Yep.
Today he's talking about his most recent project, recently completed project, An Introduction to the Medieval Bible, published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. In addition to all of this teaching and scholarship, Franz also manages, in his teaching as well, not just to engage books and thoughts, but has, with his students, made books, played games, built things. So he does multimedia teaching. He's going to focus on the medieval Bible today. So please join me. Actually, one more side thing. I need to do advertising. Future speakers, October the 16th and 17th, Paul Lim from the Vanderbilt Divinity School is going to be giving two lectures, co-sponsored by a variety of programs on Kelvin campus and also the Kelvin Seminary. One will be on Puritan theology, and a second one on a topic related to his recent work on global Christianity and human trafficking. The advertising out of the way, let me give an advertising plug to Franz's book. I read it recently. There is also a Kindle version, so if you're trying to save shelf space and you've got room on your iPad, your iPhone, or your computer, you can also download a Kindle version. It's a marvelous book. It, as you'll find out, takes us through the history of the text, the history of the making of Bibles, and also how they were used in church and in individual homes and in communities. So please join me in welcoming our speaker, Franz von Lehre.
Thank you very much, Will, and thank you all for coming here in, that's a lot of people. I was a little bit confused when Paul said, hey, we'll do a book presentation. Usually when you do a book presentation means that people talk about your book, other people talk about your book, you have coffee and cookies and all kinds of other things. And so I thought, well, it's a book celebration, I don't need to say anything. Will is going to say everything. And then I saw the advertising for this, in which Paul said he is going to give an overview of the introduction to his book. Now, it's a big topic, and the book is an introduction, and I'm going to give an overview of the introduction too. That sounds a little bit like Father Guido's five-minute university. And so I'm not going to present the medieval Bible in a five-minute university to you, but it started to dawn on me that you were actually expecting me to say something. Especially last weekend, somebody in the Spanish department said to my wife, oh, I bet you that Franz is very busy preparing his talk. And of course, I was not doing nothing of the kind, but I was getting a little bit worried that I actually should be doing that. So I got to work. So I hope that I mix in a very serious topic, and I mix in a little bit of levity as well. I know the young people will recognize this new website that I'm going to start, the His Feed. And eventually, lists is one of the things that this His Feed is going to have. And you decide whether it's LOL, win, oh my G, cute, trashy, fail, or WTF. So, I'm going to present to you seven things you thought you knew about the medieval Bible, but you really didn't. First fact. After the Council of Nicaea in 325 established the canon, the content of the Bible was basically fixed. It's a fact that that you probably encounter pretty often. It's kind of a mix of Bart Ehrman together with Dan Brown, who has created this idea that somehow what they were doing at the Council of Nicaea was fixing the canon, especially throwing out books that they didn't like very much and banning those books and maybe even burning those books. Wrong. Here's really what I think is the fact, that the canon of the Bible was not really fixed until the Council of Trent, about 1,200 years after the Council of Nicaea. It's a persistent myth that Constantine, with the Council of Nicaea, repressed alternative Christianities and banned all non-canonical writings as apocryphal. The Council of Nicaea did no such thing. There are many canon lists dating from the 4th century. I mention here the decree of Pseudo-Gelasius, the canon list of Muratori. But these canon lists do reflect a broad consensus about what should be in Scripture and what should probably not be in Scripture. There are also considerable differences as well. So there's no fixed canon even in the 4th century. One example is the letter to the Hebrews, or the revelation of John. Many of these books were still up to a lively debate on whether they should be in the canon or not. What now we consider New Testament apocrypha are sometimes also included in those 4th century canon lists. What was also going on in this period was still the discussion on the status of the Old Testament apocrypha. Are they part of the canon? Yes or no? At the same time, many New Testament apocrypha were widely popular and kept circulating. I'm talking about different infancy gospels. Infancy gospels are gospels that tell about Jesus' infancy before his adulthood, also elaborate about the birth of Jesus, or even talk about what happened to Mary before she gave birth to Jesus as well. Another New Testament apocryphum that's circulating throughout the Middle Ages is the Gospel of Nicodemus, which tells about the famous descent of Jesus into hell and what exactly is happening there in the exciting time between the crucifixion and the resurrection. So not canonical, but nevertheless widely circulating in the Middle Ages and almost regarded as good as canonical. At the same time, several texts kept circulating in the Middle Ages that were not mentioned in the 4th century canon lists, or that were rejected as late as the 16th century. I'm talking here about, for instance, about the 3rd and 4th book of Ezra. You have the book of Ezra in our canon. Nehemiah was seen as 2 Ezra, but then there are 2 extra books of Ezra, 3 Ezra and 4 Ezra, that were generally included in medieval Bibles as well. At the end of the book of Chronicles, there was an extra chapter called the Prayer of Manasses. There were extra letters of Paul called the Letter to the Laodiceans. Some Bibles had an extra psalm, Psalm 151. And there were not only the two apocryphal books of Maccabees, 1 and 2 Maccabees, but some medieval Bibles even had a 3 Maccabees or in 4 Maccabees. So really, if you are looking for a unified canon, there is a broad consensus, but there's a lot of discussion at the margins of the canon as well. And if you are looking for a conciliar decision on the canon that really says this is in and this is out, you won't find it until the Council of Trent in the 16th century. And by that time, the interesting thing is that the church was left with two canons, one for the Protestant churches and one for the Catholic churches, one including the Apocrypha, or deuterocanonical books, as the Catholic Church calls them, one excluding them, and that's the Protestant canon. All right, I think I'll take questions all at the very end and just take the seven things one by one. The Latin Bible translation used in the Middle Ages was called the Vulgate, and it was the work of Jerome. Well, everybody would say, what's wrong with that? I think that's perfectly right. Well, not entirely. It's kind of a half-truth. I think half-truths are always the most difficult ones to address. So I would say wrong. Instead, I would say, well, Jerome, the church father Jerome, around 400, from 390 to about the early decade of the 5th century, he translated most of it, but not all. There were Latin Bible translations circulating before Jerome set to work, and Jerome started out basically revising some of those Bible translations because there were many variants, many differences between them. And eventually, he decided he might as well start from scratch. He started with a book of Samuel and Kings, then went to work on the Pentateuch. He did most of the canonical books, the more narrow canonical books of the Old Testament. Then when it got, the Apocrypha, he never touched, because Jerome didn't really think that the Apocrypha should be included in the Bible. So most of the apocryphal books, like Judith, Tobit, Maccabees, parts of Esther, parts of Daniel, Jerome didn't think he should be in the Bible, so he didn't translate them. Now, of course, medieval scribes looking for a complete Bible still wanted to include those books as well, so they simply took the old translation and included them in their copies of the Bible. As for the New Testament, the Gospels, Jerome probably didn't really translate right from scratch. What he probably did is take the old Gospels that already were circulating and compare them to the Greek and revise them here and there a little bit. Now, one thing that we know that he didn't touch was, for instance, the epistles of Paul and the canonical epistles. So who translated those? Well, what we call the Vulgate translation, the current medieval the Latin translation of the epistles of Paul, probably goes back to the 5th century to Rome, where, ironically, it was circles of Pelagianists who were producing these translations. And yes, some are laughing about the irony, delightful irony. This is Paul, who is all about salvation through grace alone, who is translating his letters. It's the Pelagianists who basically say, well, there's one thing you need to do to get saved, and that's work hard, because it's all merit and no grace. So, in a way, what we have as the medieval Bible is a patchwork of different origins. Jerome is responsible for a great deal of it, but not everything. Was that called the Vulgate? Well, the interesting thing is that in the Middle Ages, when you ask somebody, well, what is the Vulgata Editio, the common edition, they were actually referring to the Septuagint, or translations going back to the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Bible. That was considered the common edition because that had been the common edition in the time of Jerome. But Jerome was doing something new, and it was certainly not common for at least a few hundred years after his death. It was not until the 16th century that his edition, his Bible translation, started to be called the Vulgata Editio, the Vulgate, the common edition. Before that, the words that were used for Jerome's edition, very often people called it the Nostra Editio, our translation, as opposed to the old translation or the common translation. Okay, next misconception. The Latin Bible was translated from the Greek, so it was an indirect translation. Luther translated the Bible directly from the Hebrew for the first time. Sounds interesting. Alas, it is wrong. Because Jerome was not working from the Greek when it came to the Old Testament. He started out with translating from the Greek. He first started basically revising Latin translations, comparing them to the Greek, and he couldn't figure it out. It is not until the year 390 when they kicked him out of Rome. There were some false rumors about his dealings with a community of noble women, sort of pious ascetic women that he was leading. All kinds of rumors that he was doing something completely different with those noble women. Eventually, he was forced out of the city of Rome. He went to Palestine in Bethlehem, learned Hebrew, and tried to tackle this question of, well, what is really the original Old Testament? And he said, it's not the Greek. And he discarded the Greek and really started to work from scratch from the Hebrew. So Jerome, for the parts that he did translate of the Old Testament, worked from the Hebrew. And as a result, throughout the Middle Ages, you have Bible scholars who, either because they want to understand Jerome's commentaries or Jerome's text better, they are inspired by Jerome, and they turn to the Hebrew in order to explain and elucidate the Latin text of the Bible. So, inspired by Jerome's following, there is a lively tradition of Hebrew scholarship throughout the Middle Ages. And in a way, Luther, well, he was going back to that tradition of medieval Hebrew scholarship when he set out to translate the Bible. Let's give Luther some credit. So Jerome did work from the Hebrew. Luther can be credited with translating from the Hebrew into German, not Latin. So the first most of the German translations up to that time were in fact indirect translations from Latin into German. But certainly Jerome was working from the Hebrew into Latin. Luther was working from the Hebrew into German. Okay, next misunderstanding. The medieval laity could not read the Bible because all Bibles were in Latin. I think this is what I run in most when I talk about the medieval Bible. Well, wasn't it all Latin, so nobody could read it? Alas, it is wrong. Here we go. First of all, there were plenty of vernacular translations in the Middle Ages. And besides, learning Latin is not as difficult as you think it is. It's not impossible. You don't have to be a priest in order to learn Latin. So this is wrong on two counts. First of all, who says that all Bibles in the Middle Ages were in Latin? Starting in the early Middle Ages, Bible and translations into the vernacular were already plentiful. I can give you a number of examples, and I have a little book display right here in front. I brought you a few. One of the earliest ones is dating as early as the 4th century, and it's the Bible translated from the Greek, incidentally, into the Gothic language. The Goths, one of the tribes that was making life in the Roman Empire kind of miserable at the time. But most of these Goths, they were not pagan barbarians. They were pious Christians in their own kind. Didn't prevent them from sacking the city of Rome. But they did have their own Bible translation. Incidentally, we don't have the entire Bible translation left. Only the New Testament has been preserved. And the Old Testament, we know that it must have existed, except for the book of Samuel and Kings, because the translator of that Gothic Bible, of the Gothic Bible into Gothic, Ulfilas, he said, well, I don't think that the Goths need any encouragement about warfare, so let's leave the book of Samuel and Kings alone. But dating from the 10th century, there is an Old Testament and then also a Gospel translation from Latin into Old English in England. The vernacular was quite commonly used, so we have Bible translations into Old English. French, at a very early stage, had a pretty complete Bible translation that was circulating. Dutch Bible translations. I know some of you are interested in Dutch. What I brought right here on the book display is a Dia Tesseron, which is kind of a gospel harmony. Gospel harmony is not that wonderful music that people make. Gospel harmony is a technical term for one gospel text that's composed out of all four gospels, because, you know, some of them have the Magi in them and some of them have the Nativity in them. So already at an early stage, people were producing gospel texts that were harmonizing the gospel story. That was translated into Latin in the probably pretty early in the 6th, 7th century. And in the 12th century, it was translated into Dutch. So most European vernaculars had their own Bibles circulating. In addition, there were lots of Bible paraphrases, poems based on the Bible that were circulating in the vernacular as well. So it's certainly not the kind that the myth, what you sometimes hear, is that the priests were trying to keep the Bible away from the common people. That just doesn't make any sense to me. I think priests were trying to do exactly the opposite in trying to make people acquainted with the content of the Bible. Besides, I think even for the laity, we have to assume that the laity in the Middle Ages had a certain command of Latin. It's not impossible to learn Latin, even if you're a lay person in the Middle Ages. And we know that we have several examples of laity that had mastered Latin, that are corresponding in Latin, and certainly also lay people who are reading Latin books as well. One example is the 9th century noblewoman Dwoda. She was the wife of one of the courtiers of Louis the Pious, who got into trouble, and as a result, both of her sons were given as hostages to the court of Louis the Pious, and it must have been heartbreaking for Dwoda, partly also because she wanted to bring them up as good God-fearing young gentlemen. So she wrote a book for them called A Handbook for My Son William, in which it's basically a manual on how to behave at court, how to not get into trouble, and certainly also not how not to get into trouble with God. She says, you know, lead pious lives, and she admonishes her sons to read the Bible, especially recite the Psalms. And she is writing this in Latin, and we may assume that her sons were also reading those Bibles in Latin as well. So Latin literacy among the laity is probably more widespread than people have assumed. All right, next one. All Bibles in the Middle Ages were painstakingly copied by monks. Well, what's wrong with that, you would say? I know that some of you have seen the Book of Kells in Trinity College Dublin, one of those beautifully illuminated Bibles. And who was responsible for these Bibles? Surely these were done, they were a work of love, painstakingly copied by pious monks in their cells while they were, you know, shivering in the cold, holding the pen, but writing the Bible, supplying the gold leaf and everything. Well, certainly there is nothing wrong with that image. And if that's, it's a wonderful romantic image, and I don't want to deprive you from that. So I would say, certainly, it's true. What makes this statement wrong is the word all. Certainly not all Bibles were the product of monastic scriptoria. Scribes of Bibles were just as often lay people and just as often women as men as well. One example, a very early example, from the workshop of the church father Origen. Origen had a sponsor called Ambrose, not the church father Ambrose, but a different one. A lay, rich person who recognized Origen's talent and gave him basically his personal scriptorium. And I want to read you a quote. It says that in his scriptorium, in this copying shop for Origen, for copying his own works, more than 7,000 shorthand writers were ready at hand, who relieved each other at fixed intervals. And as many copyists, as well as young women, who were skilled in fine writing, for all of whom Ambrose provided, without stinting, the necessary means. Now, that's what you want as a scholar, unlimited financial scholarship. But also, it's interesting that for the really fine writing, he chooses young women. Right? Well, I've got two teenage sons, and when I compare their handwriting to that of the girls in their class, I think I would call for women to be my copyists as well. Right? If you want to have fine handwriting, you need young women because they're neat. Where do these women, young women come from? We don't know anything about them. We don't even know whether these were nuns or whether they were laypersons. Fast forward a little bit to the 11th century, in which we know of a couple of examples of beautiful and very big Bibles. About this size is a page. They're called the Atlantic Bibles. Have nothing to do with the Atlantic Ocean, but have everything to do with Atlas, the big giant who has the world on his shoulders. So they're kind of giant Bibles. And these Atlantic Bibles, people have often associated them with monastic reform. And there was a movement of monastic reform going on in the Middle Ages, and many of these reform monasteries had one of those Atlantic giant Bibles. Where were they produced? Well, the interesting thing is that they were not produced by the monks or in the monastic scriptoria. They were commissioned for lay people who wanted to be benefactors of a monastery. Now, if you want to go to heaven, you better have lots and lots of monks praying for you after your death. So what do? You give a great gift to the monastery, especially the monastery who are really, you know, up on top of it, who are reform-minded, because they're the saints, and God is going to listen to them. So you donate a beautiful Bible to a reformed monastery so that they will pray for you after your death. And that's how business was done in the Middle Ages. And the interesting thing is, where were they commissioned? Very often they were written in lay scriptoria. Professional scribes in the cities, very often in Tuscany, Pisa, they were producing these Bibles, but they were done by professionals. Fast forward a little bit to the 13th century. In the 13th century, a new type of Bible started to be produced. It's called the Paris Bible, and they were tiny. They were sort of the pocket Bibles of the Middle Ages. This is the time of Franciscans and Dominicans who travel around a little, go on missions, so they are very mobile. They want small Bibles to take with them. There's actually one loose leaf of a Paris Bible here in the Heckman Library, if you want to admire that. Ask Paul Fields about it. Tiny miniature script. And these Bibles, they were done also in professional scriptoria. As a Franciscan friar, you could go to the bookstore and order yourself a Bible, and I don't know, a couple of months later, they had it ready for you. So these were professional scribes. In fact, some of the more sophisticated Bible scholars of the day were complaining about the fact that it was lay people who did it for money, because they said, well, never can be good, right? These people, they don't care about the text of the Bible. They're careless scribes, because they're lay people and they're in it for money. We better have this done by monks instead. But the fact that he was complaining that it was lay people shows that, he thought it should be done by monks, but in reality, most of the Bible production was done by lay people in professional scriptoria, and these people were writing for money. Fast forward a little bit more to the 15th century, when you can see in the movement of the Devotio Moderna, the modern devotion, a pious movement of friars in the Netherlands and in Germany. These people were very often also producing Bibles, were commissioned to copy Bibles. Sure, they were monks, or at least pious people living in convents, and or could just as well be friars or canons. But so these were religious people, but they were also, how were they making their money in a convent, right? You need a source of income for your convent. Somebody needs to buy the bread. And very often, they were getting their money because lay people were giving books to these convents in order to be copied. And very often, these books were not only prayer books, but also Bibles. So in the late Middle Ages, we have convents of monks and nuns of the modern devotion copying Bibles for lay people in order to make money. And as I said, you know, very often these were, more often than not, these convents that were specialized in Bible production were female convents. All right, next one. It was not until after the Reformation that Bibles in the vernacular were widely printed. That's a little bit tricky way that I formulate this way. But let's talk about printed Bibles as well. I just talked about the modern devotion, and I said there are a lot of lay people in this period who want to have Bibles as well. And I think that printing was invented, you know, about 75 years before the Reformation happened. It's a widely held myth that after Luther comes with the Reformation, that suddenly you have an enormous increase in biblical literacy. That suddenly Luther says, hey guys, we should start reading the Bible and just have a Bible in your home. And suddenly there's this enormous demand for Bibles, and that's when people start printing Bibles, especially Bibles in the vernacular as well. Well, the interesting thing is that the opposite really is true. The first complete Bible in Dutch was printed in 1479, before Luther was even born. And this is a printed Bible, right? Not a handwritten Bible. I have a facsimile of that printed Bible right here in front, so afterwards, if you want to have a look at that, you're welcome to look into that. So here's how the thinking has changed about the Bible, biblical literacy, and the spread of Bibles and the Reformation. And rather than now people saying, well, Luther really advocated biblical literacy, and that's when people started reading the Bible. Right now, people have actually pointed out the opposite and said, well, first, biblical literacy towards the end of the Middle Ages was steadily growing. There was an enormous demand for Bibles, handwritten Bibles, and when, you know, you can't get enough Bibles written, eventually the printing press is invented to satisfy the demand for pious books, prayer books, Bibles. But I think that it is as a result of this increased biblical literacy that Luther's Reformation could have such an enormous resonance with the people. So it's biblical literacy is preceding the Reformation rather than being a cause of the Reformation. Okay, I come to my last point. Preaching was not really done during the Middle Ages, or if it was, it was all in Latin. I'm waiting for some giggles of the Dutch people. This is your cue to laugh here.
What are you saying?
Don't know. I don't speak Latin. It doesn't make sense to me that people would go to church to listen to long sermons in Latin that they couldn't understand. Well, first of all, I think maybe they could understand some. But why would you expose people when the purpose is to educate people about the Bible? Why would you expose them to long, long sermons in Latin? It just doesn't make sense to me. So I would say, yes, that's wrong too. Connected to that is the idea that people said, oh, preaching in the Middle Ages, that was not really done until after the Reformation, that preaching became important. Well, so double wrong. Even if sermons were often written down in Latin, they were normally delivered in the vernacular, and they could be quite lively. The interesting thing about medieval sermons is that when you look at the manuscripts, sure, most of the manuscripts of medieval sermons are in Latin. But why is that? Because it was very often a secretary or a scribe who was writing down the sermon from notes, and he was doing a translation of what actually had happened, and he was, you know, listening to a sermon in the vernacular, in, let's say, Dutch, and then when he was working out his notes, he would make the translation into Latin. For who is using those notes, it's more the learned people who know Latin. The reverse is also true. When preachers are using sermons, very often they look at a sermon in order to get some ideas, to have some model sermons. They're very often looking at a Latin model, but when they're in the pulpit, they actually deliver that sermon in the vernacular. And they could be quite free in the delivery and just not look too much at the text itself. But certainly the Latin text had provided the framework for a sermon that was then held in the vernacular. So the written sources don't always exactly reflect of what was going on in the church during the service. How do we know that most of the sermons were actually done in the vernacular? Well, we know it by reports. There are sermons in the vernacular as well, and there are plenty of injunctions in councils that say, remember, you have to preach in a way that people can understand it. Here's the Council of Tours in 813 that says, every bishop should have homilies containing the necessary admonitions by which the flock should be educated on the Catholic faith in as far as they can understand it, on the perpetual reward of the good, the eternal damnation of the bad, the future resurrection of the dead, the last judgment, and with which works one might deserve eternal life and with which ones one might be excluded from it. And everyone should zealously translate these homilies into the Romance or German language so that all may more easily understand what is said. So preaching in the vernacular was commonplace, and preaching they did. There is a handbook, well, a series of handbooks called The Repertory of Latin Sermons in the Middle Ages. It's about 12 volumes, and it only covers the period 1150 to 1300, and it has thousands and thousands and thousands of not the sermons themselves, but just the mentions of the sermons and where you can find them in the manuscripts or in print. So it's just a catalog. So thousands of sermons are catalogued for that short period. After 1300, the man who was doing this repertory stopped it because he said, I can't do this anymore. There's just too much of it. And certainly many sermons are still uncatalogued in many medieval libraries. And you know, you can go and read some of these things basically for the first time since the 15th or 16th century, there is still so much to be discovered about late medieval sermons. And they could be lively. One example is the late medieval they call it the observance. It's kind of a late medieval reform movement who basically organized revival preaching. And we would say this is really typical revival preaching. These preachers would go out in the open air, have an audience of thousands of people. They would have their own little portable pulpit that they carried around everywhere. We know of one of these observance preachers that his pulpit had a little weather vane on top, so people could see where the wind was coming from, so you could sit downwind, so you can hear better what the preacher is saying. And these people were quite lively. Father Brugman is one of them in Dutch, Bertolt of Regensburg in German, Bernardino of Siena in Italy. Bernardino of Siena, at one point, he had an audience of thousands of people that followed him everywhere around for miles and miles, it says. And it says that after one of his sermons, the crowd was shouting, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus," for 3 solid hours after his sermon. So that sounds like a revival meeting to me. So some of these preachers had lively tricks as well. We know of one sermon, Father, I think it was Friar Bertolt, who was always carrying around a skull under his cloak. And at a dramatic moment, he would produce this big skull and show it to the people and say, "Here is death. And pretty soon, you will be dead too. You better convert before you are dead." Another friar, he had another trick. One of the chronicles says that he covered himself with his cloak, put his hood over his head, and was entirely silent and remained like that for minutes and minutes and minutes. And people thought, what's going to happen next? Well, the trick was that nothing happened, but it sure got the attention of the audience. So lively preaching in the vernacular is something that is, I think, typical of the Middle Ages rather than something that was not done in the Middle Ages. Now, with that, I come to the end of my talk. You didn't know about this one, right, Will?
That's not in any of the sources I've seen.
In any case, I'm very happy to entertain some questions. We have plenty of time for questions.
Could you go back one slide? And I don't read Dutch, and I've forgotten my Latin.
Oh, I'm sorry. Je krijgt er geen speld tussen. You can't stick a needle in between it. Meaning, this guy is talking so much, you can't even stick a needle in between. Nee, je kan praten als Brugman. This observance preacher, Father Brugman, he made it into a Dutch proverb. Talking like Brugman means he just talks and talks and talks and talks and talks.
Given your subversion of all of our generalizations about Latin Bibles, what role did Erasmus's New Testament play in the modernization of scripture text?
Well, it's important, of course, in that this is the first critical edition of the Greek Bible text. Now, one thing is that if any text was dominant in the Middle Ages, it was the Latin Bible text. Scholars did go back to the Hebrew. They did go back to the Greek as well. But especially for Greek, it was hard to get a good Bible text in Greek. There were quite a few variants in the text as well. So Erasmus is the first one to produce a critical edition of the Greek New Testament for use by scholars. And that's the one that, for instance, Luther made good use of when he produced his translation from the Greek into the German as well. There were other scholars like Valla was working on the same project as well. Barbara?
Could you talk a little bit about in what kind of form was Jerome got the Bible pieces? And this was just
yeah.
5th century and then later on?
Jerome had a had a little friend. We don't know his name, but he calls him the Hebraeus Maos, my Jew. So he had his little private Jew who was coming up, and it says he was coming with providing him with scrolls. So he had contacts in with the Jewish community, and he had a friend there who was showing him the scrolls and also explaining the intricacies of the Hebrew Bible to him. Now, there's somewhat of a trick, is that Jerome, there was a lot of scholarship before Jerome as well, and most of it done by Origen as well. And Origen had put together a book called we called the Hexapla, the Sixfold. It was six versions of the Bible side by side, including Hebrew, including the common translation, the Septuagint translation, but there were also two translations from Hebrew into Greek circulating at the same time, one by a man called Aquila, the other one by a man called Theodotion, and both of these were coming from a Jewish background. There's a great book about that Timothy Michael Law called When God Spoke Greek. You know, most of the Bibles were in Greek at the time. Even Jews were reading the Bible mostly in Greek. But when Christians mainly started using the Septuagint, many Jews were unhappy with the text of the Septuagint, and especially because some of it was used for proofs that Christ really had come. So many Jewish communities started producing their own Greek translations from the Hebrew. And that's the translation of Aquila, for instance. And we know that Jerome used Aquila and Theodotion and the Septuagint and the Hebrew, and he very conveniently had it all together in the Hexapla by Origen, which regrettably has not been preserved in a copy. Yes. Throughout the Middle Ages, we have examples of Hebrew scholarship very often went through personal contacts. If you really want to learn Hebrew, you better go to the rabbi and he'll teach you. Or if you don't quite know Hebrew, you can always ask somebody in the synagogue, so what does it really say? What does your Bible say here? And, you know, most Jews in the Middle Ages, they weren't speaking Hebrew. They were speaking French or Spanish or German. And, of course, Hebrew was a sacred language. So they were conversing about the Bible text in whatever language they had in common. Christians and Jews spoke French. Say, hey, you know, in Latin says this. What does it say in Hebrew? You can see examples of that throughout the Middle Ages. And then, of course, there are a couple of examples of Jews who converted to Christianity, who brought their expertise with them as well. And, well, sometimes there's one example of a 9th century commentary according to, you know, it says the commentary, Hebrew questions on the Bible, and was done by probably an anonymous convert. And he must have been quite popular because people said, hey, this is interesting stuff. Tell us more about these Hebrew traditions. And in some cases, he was just making them up because he just didn't know enough to satisfy the demand of his new co-religionists. But certainly, there were contacts back and forth, and of course, partly converts were also providing some Hebrew expertise for medieval Christians as well. Dale. No. Well, the Confessio Belgica, the Belgic Confession, does have a book list. And I'm not quite sure about the other confessions, but certainly the Belgic Confession does have a book list. When is it established? The interesting thing is that throughout the Middle Ages, there are voices that say, well, all the other books are not really canonical. there is a lively discussion about the deuterocanonical books throughout the Middle Ages. Jerome was an advocate for a smaller Bible. Augustine said, no, no, you can't do that. In fact, Augustine and Jerome were completely at odds about Bible translating and about the Bible canon as well. And Augustine at one point is, he didn't have any good words for the new translation that Jerome had as well. In fact, there were in Jonah, the miracle tree that Jonah is sitting under, it's a kikayon in Hebrew, and the old Latin translation had translated it as a vine, and Jerome says, no, it's a cucurbita, it's a cucumber. And Augustine is reporting that people were up in arms. People started rioting in the street when they started reading Jonah in church. And, you know, they were probably throwing cucumbers at each other or something. But it caused a riot. People were, and so Augustine said, well, there are good reasons to stick to the Greek as your original text. He says, first of all, it's what everybody reads. He said, second of all, it's what our brothers in the East are reading. So you don't want to have a totally different Bible in the East and in the West. You know, unity of Christians. And there were a couple of other arguments that he had as well, but I forget about them. Well, oh, and then of course people start rioting in the street. You don't want to have that as well.
There's one follow-up question, Dennis. Was anybody reading the Quran during the religious?
Yes, yes. The first Quran translations start appearing in about 1140. It's the monastery of Cluny, heavily invested in pilgrimage to Spain. They were quite interested in what Islam was and what exactly this teaching of Mahomet was all about. So it's Peter the Venerable who first commissioned a translation of the Quran in the 1140s. And he had a commission work on it of a couple of Spanish Christians. And there was an Englishman, Robert of Ketton, who lived in Spain, who also worked together with it as well. So that was from the 12th century, the Latin translation of the Quran was available, and that actually remained the main translation of the Quran until I think the 16th century. It was prefaced by a little treatise, you know, about the errors of the ungodly doctrine of Muhammad, and so that people knew what they had, and that they would use caution when reading it.
Was it to for different kinds of people with different wealth to own whole Bibles, or you know maybe in different books, but the whole Bible is only parts of it?
You know, we think of the Bible as the whole Bible, a book, everything in one book, cover to cover, and everything is in there. Well, okay, some have the Apocrypha and some don't have the Apocrypha. So what a whole Bible is even a little bit questionable even in our time. My son calls the Apocrypha the bonus Bible. You thought you had everything, but oh, there's a little bit more. So, in a way, there's Bibles have many different forms in the Middle Ages, and it's hard to say something in general about what Bibles looked like. You do have pandects, everything in one cover, the whole Bible right there. The Atlantic Bibles generally were pandects as well. The oldest extant Latin Bible that we have, the Codex Amiatinus, is a pandect as well. The Paris Bibles, you had everything in one as well. But generally more common were Bibles that either divided it up in different volumes, because it's just a very big book to have in one volume. So sometimes we have them in four parts, six parts, eight parts, nine parts, everything there. And then, of course, you have the more specialized Bibles for liturgical use, gospel books, like the Book of Kells in Trinity College Dublin is not really a Bible. Everybody calls it a Bible, but it's really a gospel book containing the four gospels because it's for liturgical use. And depending on what you're reading in the liturgy, you know, you take one book or the other one. So yeah, I think partial Bibles are just as common as pandects. Wisdom used to say, scholars used to say, oh, pandects were rare and we don't see much of them, and all the Bibles were partial Bibles. The more I look at it, I think there are so many exceptions to that rule that I think we have to revise the rule that pandects were just as common as partial Bibles. But yeah, what is a Bible, right? When the Gideons are handing out Bibles, it's actually New Testament and Psalms and Proverbs, right? So is that a Bible? And I think similar questions we have we had in the Middle Ages as well. And then, related to it is also the question, so if you have a poetic paraphrase of the Bible, do you call that the Bible?
Like the Good News Bible.
Or even more so, just a children's Bible. Is a children's Bible a Bible, right? So in the Middle Ages, there is an enormous variety of biblical texts. And so when you say, well, pure Bibles that look exactly like our Bibles, you know, then you come to maybe a somewhat meager count. But if you say, well, okay, people defined Bible in a different way, then there's a huge, huge proliferation of biblical literature.
In your book, what are you proudest of that you put out? You know, what do you think? Oh, this is really good that people need to know that. You suggest a little bit, but can you tell us what
you've seen the highlights. what I also really am proud of is the chapters on biblical interpretation and biblical hermeneutics. I think that's where that's kind of the furthest away and the most alien to what people think about when they read the Bible. And that was the biggest challenge of making that comprehensible for a large audience. But what I really try to do is, you write an introduction. Most of the time you go with secondary literature and you try to condense secondary literature in a comprehensible way. I really try to go to the sources, and I really try to look at Bibles, read commentaries, and try to communicate that primary source research in my book as well. So it's not really an introduction in a sense that it's all based on secondary sources. I really try to go to the sources, but also incorporate those sources in the book. And there are quite a few quotations from sources in translation that are not available there unless you know Latin. So in that sense, I really try to give people something that's original research. Excellent question, and the answer is no. We don't know. It is really hard to gauge something like literacy rate for that time period. A number of observations. One is that it dramatically changes as the Middle Ages go on, and it must be completely different for the early Middle Ages, when I assume literacy was much lower, than in the High Middle Ages, when you see a growing middle class that clearly is literate as well. And that's why this demand for professionally produced Bibles and prayer books and all that is increasing as well. So there is a big change from one time to the next. The other thing is that you have different kinds of, in fact, I have half a chapter on literacy in the book as well. What is literacy? And as you already indicate, there is different ways of being literate. Right? Reading and writing, 100% literacy, I think was probably much rarer than people who can read but not write. And many people didn't need to read or write, even when you have literacy in higher classes and among nobility, you've got people to do the reading and writing for you, right? So you have Charlemagne. We know about Charlemagne, the life of Charlemagne by Einhard. and says, well, he loved to read this, he loved to read the City of God, and he loved to read that, and he was making all these reforms, this and that, so he must have been highly literate. But then Einhard says, well, he never really learned how to write himself. So was he literate, yes or no? No, he could kind of write his name, but you don't need to, if he wanted to write something, he just called somebody in and who he dictated things. So lots of writing was done by dictation. Yeah, and lots of reading was done by reading too as well. So is that literacy, yes or no? Right, you have to be very modified those concepts a lot in order to understand what literacy means in the Middle Ages. Go ahead.
Can I ask you how preachers would have used the Bible in their sermons? And especially that there, yep. there are two possibilities. One is sort of the classic Reformed where you pick a passage and you explicate God's truth in that passage, or part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or one can use scripture for colorful examples.
Yeah.
If you want to make sort of talk about one of the seven deadly sins.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I think, you know, you have many different kinds of medieval sermons, and some more for big audiences and laity revival sermons, and some of them more for a learned audience. And so there are different kinds of sermons. I think the most common sermon what we have is what I would call catechetical preaching, the latter. You have topic indexes of, you know, the seven deadly sins, and they loved numbers, the 14 this and the 2 that and the 5 that, and the so, and there it's not just Bible, it's all kinds of examples that come in. There is one wonderful example of a friar who in the middle said, and then King Arthur, and suddenly everybody in his audience went like this. And then he says, scolded them, said, look, you guys were asleep, but when I mentioned King Arthur, you all woke up, huh? Now, were only that you would listen to the gospel with the same attention. So many of these sermons were, I wouldn't call them exegetical preaching. They were more catechetical expository preaching, even though they very often started with a Bible text, but that was a way to freely flow all over the place. On the other hand, we do know that expository preaching, exegetical preaching also happened. Many university preachers were very proud of their exegetical sermons, and we call them the postilla. And many of these postilla got collected in books, commentaries. And we know that Luther, for instance, made a lot of use in his own sermons, but also in his Bible translation from these postilla that he found everywhere. There's an interesting book by Hans Freimeyer about the postilla. It says when you really start looking at the postilla, Catholics and Protestants were not really doing much essentially different in the 16th century when it came to exegetical and expository preaching, despite the big differences in doctrine, obviously. So I hope that answers your question. I see Paul approaching, so I guess that means we have to.
Well, let's thank you very much.
Very welcome.